They probe them the same way they might study a regular atom. For each round of the experiment, Alpha scientists shot 500 anti-hydrogen atoms with laser pulses, causing the atom's electrons to jump into a higher energy state. The electrons then drop back, and the anti-hydrogen atoms release photons with a characteristic wavelength. This is the well-known Lyman-alpha transition, used frequently in astronomy to study very distant objects. Let me drop for a second. The researchers measured the photons that came out, and they were essentially the same as wavelengths you'd expect from regular hydrogen atoms, according to the study published in Nature. At this point, researchers continued to see that properties they hoped might differ between matter and antimatter appear to be the same. But this experiment has an important second use. They want to use it to do laser cooling of antihydrogen. This is the first demonstration that their new laser cooling method is doable in experiments. Physicists use lasers to trap and cool atoms to temperatures extremely close to absolute zero. Observing the electron jumping up to the energy level and releasing photons in response to laser pulse and antihydrogen is a decisive technological step, according to the paper. It demonstrates that scientists may soon be able to laser cool antimatter atoms as well. That will allow them to perform more precise measurements. Let me drop for a second. Alpha, for example, will soon be upgraded with equipment that will allow it to drop anti-hydrogen atoms to see whether they interact with gravity differently than hydrogen atoms do. This will be an important test. Now, I'm betting that gravity behaves the same way on antimatter that it does on matter, and I wonder what the odds are that Las Vegas are giving on this thing. Let me drop for any questions or comments. Once again, this is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Is that the best that they could do, just with hydrogen? They haven't been able to manufacture any other element in the antimatter group? As far as you know, Roy, is that it?
Gosh, you're a difficult guy. The problem with anything bigger is, in order for it to be stable, you now have to have a device that creates antineutrons in addition to the antiprotons and the positrons, because if you put two antiprotons together in a nucleus, they will be very unhappy. So I guess it's waiting for a smart guy to figure out how to create antineutrons in a effective and cost-effective way.
Okay, very good. I know on the space station they have the alpha magnetic, spectrometer, I believe it is, for antimatter in the universe, and they find it all the time. So I guess they could track that and see where it's going, and if it's being bent near a star or a galaxy or something, then they could say, gravity is, pulling on this stuff. That might be the only other way then, if this doesn't work.
Well, I would say give it time. I don't know if they're actually detecting any anti large atoms. That's something that I haven't heard of yet. Again, because it's really difficult to build something stronger than a hydrogen atom, although anything is possible. As far as antimatter is concerned, I mean, we all kind of say, and I've said it in this little report, that it's only one out of a billion of particles is antimatter, but I am sure in your pantry you have a source of antimatter this very day, the lowly banana. The lowly banana is made of a lot of potassium, as are potatoes and other fruits and vegetables, and potassium has a percentage of potassium-40, which is radioactive, and decays into different things. They decay into betas, electron particles, but also to a very small degree, they decay into positrons, into positively charged anti-electrons. So in your own pantry is a source of a very, very, very small amount of antimatter, as is we, because we have sodium in our bodies as well, and some of it, again, is sodium potassium, rather, is potassium-40, which is mildly radioactive. So don't worry. It's not going to harm you, but it's part of life.
Okay, I guess that would be true in your earlier statement. You were saying that they found out they have one in a billion atoms. So I guess, you know, would be anti-matter particles. So, okay, I guess that banana would have a lot of antimatter particles. No wonder it doesn't explode. Those particles are going to meet up with other positive particles in the banana. But, okay, very good, Roy. Interesting. Back to you. I'll let you continue.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I mean, the positrons do annihilate each other, and if you had a lot of them, it would make things very difficult in your kitchen. But fortunately, there's so few of them that the amount of gamma radiation created, if you have a very sensitive scintillator, you can detect the radiation discharge of a banana and such. But it's thankfully very small. And one of the weird things is, I'm sure everyone has heard about a liquefying room air. If you pressurize it, you get mostly nitrogen and some oxygen, but you also get argon. And the funny thing about the argon is almost about 99% of the argon in our room air is actually caused by radioactive decay of potassium-40 that decays into argon. So when you blow up a balloon or whatever you do with argon, I assume vacuum tubes at one point had some argon in it, then it's thanks to the radioactive decay of potassium-40.
Yeah, okay, I used to weld with the stuff, you know, and have the argon as a backup gas tungsten inert gas welding, ilioc welding. And the common gas they used was argon, and we used it like it was going out of style, so there's plenty of it in the air, I guess. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, it's neutral, but it isn't as light as helium, which would kind of rise to the top of the atmosphere and start to kind of fade away. Argon pretty much stays by gravity and such, and so that's the beauty. Argon is almost like a waste product. When they're liquefying oxygen or liquefying nitrogen, they end up getting a lot of argon, so they bottle it and they sell it. Most antiparticles don't really last that long, again, because a billion more pieces of matter are around that they can collide to and annihilate. So the primary way that we see antimatter is its creation from radioactive decay of regular matter. And that's the way it seems that it's going to be for a while. One of the great mysteries that's certainly worth a Nobel Prize is to figure out in what way there's a broken symmetry between matter and antimatter, and why at the end of the Big Bang or whatever it was, we were left with such a big amount of matter, fortunately, and very, 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 very little antimatter.
Yeah, I know. I've read that. They figured that one of them had to be just a little out of balance, and this is the one that we live in. Yeah, matter that we live with. I guess that, of course, has not been resolved yet. We'll have to wait another 10 years or so, maybe longer, before someone figures that one out. But very good, Roy. I'll let you continue on to the next one.
Okay, very good. I mean, I hope they figure it out soon. It may take longer than 10 years. You never know. The scam that scientists kind of consider the matter is they say that its symmetry is not balanced, and one out of a billion is the imbalance. But then they fail to explain what the nature of the imbalance is. So that's where the next Nobel Prize in that subject goes. Someone who figures out why there's the imbalance, not that there is an imbalance. Let me drop and I'll move on to the next one. Okay, hopefully you remember last month when I mentioned that there was different ways to measure the Hubble constant, the expansion rate of the universe. The two methods presently in use involve calculations based on a standard candle of variable stars called Cepheid variables, while the other method involves the cosmic microwave background. Now, the big problem is that these two methods produce two slightly different values for the Hubble constant. Well, we seem to have developed a similar problem with gravity right now. Gravity might feel strong if you drop a bowling ball on your foot, but in fact, it's the weakest force of all the four fundamental forces. Compared to electromagnetism, the pull of all the Earth's gravity can't stop you from picking up a paperclip with a refrigerator magnet. That weakness makes gravity incredibly difficult to measure. A team of scientists in China reporting that they have now performed the most precise measurement of gravity's strength yet by measuring G, the Newtonian or universal gravitational constant. G relates the gravitational attraction between two objects to their masses and the distance between them. The new measurement is important both for high-powered atomic clocks as well as the study of the universe, Earth science, or any kind of science that relies on gravity in some way. Let me drop for a second. The values measured by the team have the smallest uncertainties reported until now, according to a paper published in Nature. Before we get to the experiment, a little more about what G is. Isaac Newton realized that gravity's strength depends on the masses of two objects, like a planet and a moon, and weakens in relation to the distance between these masses squared. But in order to calculate the actual gravitational force between two things, you have to multiply the combined masses divided by the distance squared by a very, very, very tiny number. Henry Cavendish first indirectly measured that number, G, in the late 18th century. Now, given how small it is, determining the true value of G is very difficult, and the agreed-upon value set by the International Committee on Data for Science and Technology is much less precise than the value on for other numbers that scientists regularly use. Today, the scientists use the value 6.674080000, give or take 47 parts per million. Now, in a new study, scientists performed two independent calculations of G using a pair of pendulums in a vacuum, one pendulum set up for each test. Each pendulum swings back and forth between a pair of massive objects whose positions can be adjusted. Let me drop for a second. The pendulums measure the force of gravity in two ways. First, they measure the difference between how quickly the pendulum swung to the near or parallel position versus the far or the horizontal position. They also measured how the direction of the pendulum swing changed based upon the pull of the test masses. Now, obviously, the experiments require super-sensitive detectors and super-well-controlled setups in order to determine accurate values for G. Each part must be specially fabricated and considered so that only possible force acting on the pendulum could come from the test masses. Additionally, the lab is in a special room in a cave to control the possible effects from changing temperatures. Let me drop for a sec. The researchers ended up measuring 6.674184 and 6.674484 hundred billionths for the time of the swinging and the angular acceleration methods, respectively. These measures were both very precise, but are still different from one another for unknown reasons. Now, this might have something to do with the string used for the pendulum, but at this point, they don't know. The study is a perfect example of excellent craftsmanship in precision measurement. However, the true value of G remains unclear. Various determinations of G that have been made over the past 40 years have had a wide spread of values. Although some of the individual relative uncertainties are of the order of 10 parts per million, the difference between the smallest and the largest values calculated are about 500 parts per million, which is rather big. Let me drop for any questions or comments. Once again, this is AC2GS. Okie dokie. Russia has been using variants of their proton rockets in its space program since 1965, and the design is showing its age. For starters, every launch is an experimental mess. Proton uses toxic chemicals where newer rockets have moved on to cleaner fuels. The country will have to put up with technology for a while longer, however. Rostec Corporation Council Chairman Yuri Koptev has warned that Angara Proton's long-delayed successor isn't expected to replace the older rocket before 2024. Kuptov didn't explain why it would take so long, but he was confident that the high cost of Angara would come down through refinements. It would be an understatement to say that Angara's development time has been protracted. The first plans materialized in 1992, but Proton's success beyond Russian borders led to developers putting development on the back burner. The first test flight failed in 2009, and the first successful test didn't come until 2014. The Angara rocket family won't have its first official flight until 2019. It's still taking baby steps towards full service, 26 years after work began, and there aren't any hints that its developers are picking up the pace. Let me drop for a second. When Angara does replace Proton, you'll likely hear a sigh of relief from those poor guys in Kazakhstan. The country has criticized Russia for using such a hazardous rocket at the Baikonur Space Facility, and Angara, which uses safer liquid oxygen and refined petroleum, should have a considerably reduced impact. As it stands, Russia's rocket program could stand some freshening up when rockets like SpaceX Falcon series and ESA's Vega are pushing technological boundaries. Let me drop for any questions or comments.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, Angara, I know, is supposed to have a whole family of rockets for small, medium, and heavy launch vehicles. So they have tested one about a year or so ago, but now I think probably 2 years now, and that was a medium class one. They've yet to do the small one or the larger one. So, you know, it's under development, but proton rockets were they were originally built for intercontinental ballistic missiles, so they have these toxic chemicals that they would use, and the only reason they like them is they could leave them in a silo for years, you know, years or 10, 20, 30 years, it didn't matter, and they were always ready to launch, so that's how they got to where they are, and the Soyuz too is going to be, they want to phase out the Soyuz and eventually go to Angara. But the cost is, Russia's in trouble financially, so they're having trouble with building the new Angaras. But eventually they're going to replace Soyuz and Proton. Back to you.
Very good. Thank you, Paul. I wasn't quite aware of how toxic the Proton rockets were sort of designed to be. They didn't really care about the stuff that they let out as they fly up, so thankfully we're not anywhere near their emission area, but this stuff tends to kind of get around the scope, so I'll be happier when they move on to a slightly safer propellant.
Yeah, China is trying to change too. As well, I think they want to go over to RP-1. RP-1 is really a refined kerosene that we use in a lot of our rockets now. We've gotten away from a lot of the poisonous gases. We used to do the same thing to some degree, but that's all gone. United States, I believe, even the Delta 2, that's being phased out next month. They've had probably 100 flights more over the years, and they were RP-1. So, you know, we've been using pretty good fuel for a long time, but not the Russians or China. And I believe India is still using some of the bad fuels as well.
Well, I guess they're going for less expense. They don't quite have as much money to throw around as we tend to. And hopefully they'll learn better over time and be better neighbors. You know, things were dangerous in general back in the good old days before there were seat belts. And I still remember when I was in college, I would regularly bore holes into asbestos boards and spread the fibers all over the lab. And we had bottles and bottles of organic solvents like benzene, guaranteed to pickle people's liver. And even farther back, they used to have those microscopy machines in stores where people could expose themselves to X-rays as much as they would like.
Very good. Yeah, and the mercury in the thermometers, I remember the one doctor I had, he said, when we were kids, we used to play with this stuff, you know. Oh, look at this cool mercury.
Yeah, there's still guys who do it on YouTube. I mean, there was one where they did a little experiment by dropping an anvil in a bucket of liquid mercury to see if it would float or sink.
I have to ask, what happened?
It floats. Iron and steel have a lower density than liquid mercury.
Oh, very good. Wow. Very good, Roy.
Yes, Wesley.
The last time I mentioned Satan, which is a Russian nuclear reactor rocket. Find some more information about it. The nuclear reactor generates the heat to heat up a burning chamber and exhaust nozzle. So to add on the pressure and increase exhaust jet speed. The engine cooling system is the fuel preheating system that cools the burning chamber and exhaust nozzle and jet out hot and pressured fuel to burn in explosion mode. Let me jump. The heat the nuclear reactor provided adds on more expansion force to increase burning chamber pressure and force exhaust gas jet out faster to increase the thrust for the same amount of fuel consumption that non-nuclear aided engine. That's one. But they have another one, which is Saturn. Saturn, I don't know, it's an English word. Two. And that one is actually a heavy chunk of hot nuclear material. And very primitive heat exchange unit that created thrust. Now, this thing can fly forever, and it leaves behind the heavy trace of radioactive material. So it's easy to spot, but at the same time, it contaminates the atmosphere. I didn't find yet which exactly place that 37 minutes flight, which were four flights, of that vessel, of that rocket pulled into Barents Sea. That was the one of the place, but I have to check it out. So it's 48 to 58 tons of fuel of oxygen that Saturn 1. Saturn 2 is fueling nuclear material. And to exceed.
That's very interesting and very scary. If you have any further information, links, feel free to email them to me. I'd love to read them and get nightmares later. I don't know. I'm not afraid the Russians are going to invade and take us over. I'm afraid that they're going to do something incredibly stupid and ruin it for all of us on this planet. They don't seem to be operating in a cautious manner at all for about anything. It's kind of like the party is going to be over in an hour or two, so why not all of the vodka?
Actually, what Russian trying to do is rectify the 1967 project. United States of America was trying that and found that to be completely unacceptable. Russia stopped at 71, I believe. And so they have two concepts. In other words, the one of the concept, the first one is turbine compressor to force the dense air into be mixed with the fuel to burn in the burning chamber. Well, that's in three in one. Nuclear power eight turbine, impulse rocket, trite engine. That's how would I describe that. But that is not flying forever. The second one, a fully nuclear one, is the one that Russia was trying to scare during Putin's speech. It was a few months ago, half a year ago. Can fly indefinitely and could be directed to any possible place. Now, the second weapon that they have, let me drop. It's a sort of submarine. So actually, it's a missile that could go to the border of United States, to any place, let's say New York, and then blow up. So let's say we have that kind of thing in Hudson River, and now in the middle of New York it blows up. Entry here.
Well, just about 6 months ago, people were questioning everyone that now that North Korea has nuclear capability, they don't necessarily have to launch them into missiles. They can just put them on a slow boat from Korea, and when they get near the port, trigger it and cause havoc. So there's an almost infinite number of ways for us human beings to screw world, and I hope that somehow we get around without anyone doing any of it.
Well, we may take it as a joke, or we may take it as a nut. Russian claim that that kind of submarine missile is nuclear power, nuclear engine powered, so it could go wherever they want. It could height, and it could be reactivated. So, interesting stories. How do they keep the communication with such scary device? And to actually,
your call is
well, that leads to my next story. Actually, it's from MIT, so the Russians don't have it, but they might steal it any day now.
That's right. And to actually, and thank you.
Thank you too, Wes. Next up is submarines can't normally communicate directly with anything above the water due to the physical limits of their signals. But that might change in the near future. Researchers have developed a wireless system that can transmit data from an underwater source to the air. The approach, known as translation acoustic RF communication, sends a sonar signal to the surface, where tiny vibrations at different frequencies correspond to zeros and ones of binary data. Above the water, an extreme high-frequency radar, 30 gigahertz to 300 gigahertz, can pick up on changes in signal angles that relate to the data bits. It's just a matter of processing the bits into meaningful data after that. Translational acoustic RF communication doesn't even require a perfectly still sea either. New signal processing algorithms use the frequency of waves to tell the difference between large waves and the tiny ones scientists are looking for. The initial approach only works in waves nearly 6.3 inches high, but MIT hopes to refine it for use in rougher ocean waters. Let me drop for a second. The system isn't about to transmit photos or highly detailed reports, since the current prototype can only transmit data at a few hundred bits per second. Decades-old dial-up modems were faster. And of course, it's focused on a one-way transmission. Even that little bit of data might be enough for all kinds of applications, though. Submarines could send their findings directly to aircraft, including drones, circling around while remaining underwater and without using boats as intermediaries. That could keep sailors out of harm's way and make transmissions possible in situations where conventional ships just aren't available. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Okay, I have a comment. Let me drop. Cut me off here. It's 1952. The subsonic, so it's over 20 kilohertz signal that is transmitted from the submarine and creates vibration from the surface of the water. And that vibration is picked up due to the Doppler effect and then is being converted. So, in other words, is it the same concept that actually doesn't send any signal to drone? Drone must of look at the vibration and look at the signal and eventually to convert the signal. The problem is waves. And to XJM.
Well, if I understand it correctly, all that the Doppler effect would demonstrate would be a signal, say, of velocity of the submarine. It really wouldn't be able to impart any other data stream. This is kind of designed to give you enough binary data to give you a small amount. It's a very slow symbol rate, but it's better than we have presently. But I'm not quite sure how a Doppler-related ultrasonic signal could be modulated. It's dependent upon the velocity of the vehicle.
Zoom Wing, the first spying devices to look at the conversation in a room were built. So you are sitting in your room and you're talking to another person. The glass vibrates. You may use laser for it, but you may use a very high frequency Doppler effect. Now you're seeing a physical vibration, so it's longitudinal wave that is impacting the glass. And from that, you are able, by sending the signal and receiving the signal, to encode the conversation. So in other words, in this scenario, if I understand it properly, the drone is active and the water is the medium that's supposed to be read. And to XGA.
So the water is kind of the passive and the drone or whatever is in the air is the radar detection device. And yes, it's somewhat reminiscent of the old spy device where people would shine lasers on polished glass and sound would cause the glass to vibrate, which would cause interference patterns, which could then be re-encoded as audio signals and heard. It becomes much more problematic when you replace the nice, sharp, smooth piece of glass with waves on top. So I think this is a significantly dramatic improvement upon that technology.
My question to you is, we're talking about 1952, and we now have reincarnation of the idea, like Russian from 1956 want to reincarnate the nuclear engine for the rocket. What is the difference? And that's what I hardly am able to understand and to achieve.
I'm not sure exactly what you're getting at by what is the difference. I don't think the laser detector for Windows was practical until probably the 70s, because it used to need a laser, and lasers weren't around in the 70s. So that was kind of... And there are still articles out there that questions whether they're technologically possible. You know, there are kits to build them, but people say that they don't work, and there's all kinds of strange things. But I'll accept that if you have enough money to throw at it, the lasers and the glass work. So I'm not quite sure what you mean.
Modern systems used by police use four antennas, and ham radio use four antennas. The difference in distance between those antennas could be 10 centimeters, so let's say 5 inches. And by that, they are able to actually read the position of those antennas. But that makes also more sense if you increase the frequency. Now, the difference between two objects in physical distance could be extremely small. So the radio waves are taking work that was done by laser, and radio waves using Doppler effect are able to see the difference between the water of the water vibration. Again, the problem is waves. How could you then fight with the waves when the ocean is not quiet? So that's kind of struck me that, well, they're trying to have a communication, and what is the new, what is new in what was in 1952?
I would assume a combination of things. It's the ultra high frequency radar equipment that can be fitted on a drone. It's the algorithm that can detect and throw out the noise of regular ocean waves versus the ultrasonic waves produced by the submarine, and putting it all together in some very bright engineering students, professors at MIT.
Yeah, I'm assuming that a square root of the distance could describe how much power should be pushed into the transmitter on submarine in order for the surface of the water to significantly vibrate. And to exceed.
I would assume that the ultrasonic emitters are highly directional for that very reason.
So we have another problem. Positioning of submarine versus a high-frequency, super-high-frequency radar that is actually read those vibrations. But nothing has changed. The idea from 1952, or the idea that was actually implemented by using laser on the glass in the window, is exactly the idea that is being used right now, only that the coding possibly is different. And to exceed.
Okay, but again, I'm a little confused by your citing the 1950s and lasers, and they weren't there, so they used something else. But no matter what, I think the big thing, at least that I take away from this, is the fact that all of the background noise of ocean wave disturbances can be filtered out using sophisticated algorithms. I think that's the primary advance here. The rest are just tweaking and kind of taking things that are already there and kind of pushing them a little bit further into the bleeding edge.
Well, in 1950s, they didn't use lasers. They used infrared. I remember I was a young kid in the 60s, and I was playing with an infrared transmitter and receiver. So actually, by using infrared, which frequency is pretty high, you are able to see all of those vibrations. And to exchange.
I would assume that the fact that you're dealing with incoherent light sources would be a very big problem.
There was a Polish book called Electronic Voice. And we as a kids, we were actually playing with that stuff. Yes, you're right. Actually, you dig in internet, you can find plenty of those spying devices that you could spy on the window of the neighbor and listen to what they talk about. Now, how reliable they are, it's a different story, but the idea is not new. But anyhow, I do thank you for the information and to exchange.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Wesley. I appreciated your participation. It's coming up close to 11 o'clock, and I do want to give Paul the opportunity to do his space report. So I just want to remind people of a couple little things. Everything that I talk about will have links available on the webpage roy.ac2gs.com. And if you want to contact me, don't look on that webpage for an address. You just use mailbag@ac2gs.com, or you can look me up in QRZ, whichever you prefer. And I won't be here next week. It's Rosh Hashanah to fellow tribe, Lashana Tova. To you, thank you very much, and week. This is AC2GS.
Thank you, Roy. Good stuff. Paul, you ready with the next space report? WS2N, K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, very good. And this is WS2N for net, space net number 314, gapping. And Roy, you know, stick around. I don't have all that much, so maybe we could fill in a little bit at the end. If you have more, that would be okay. There isn't all that much going on. I mean, there's a lot of things that are going to be happening in the near future, but immediately there haven't been any dramatic launches or anything. One problem on the International Space Station has occurred last week, though. They've come up with a leak. In fact, they've a small leak. Ground control monitors all the instruments while they were sleeping. They noticed a drop in air pressure inside the ISS. And the ISS runs at 14.7 pounds per square inch. Same pressure that have right here on Earth. And then they decided to leave the crew asleep. There's six people on board right now. Because it was a very, very small leak. And, they'll get to it when they wake up. And it turned out it was so small that if it was left alone, it would take a total of 18 days to actually shoot off all the air in the ISS. So it turned out to be located in the orbital module of the Soyuz spacecraft, one of the manned spacecraft that are attached. There's two spacecraft attached that have brought people up, so three in each one. And then there's a Progress spacecraft that's also docked with the space station. And it turns out that closing all the different doors, you know, from module to module, they pinned it down to the orbital section of the Soyuz spacecraft. Now, the Soyuz spacecraft consists of three main sections. If you look at it, it's got the front part is the orbital part, they call that, and then the center part is the descent module, or launch module, same thing. And then the back section is their service module, with all the thrusters, fuel, and power, and, you know, water and everything. So it turns out it was in the orbital module. The orbital module, you know, when they launch, they're sitting in the middle of this, that whole spacecraft called the descent module. Module in front of them is called the orbital. That's where they would go after they launch. If you ever seen pictures of the three astronauts when they launch, they're just jammed in there in the Soyuz spacecraft. This one was called the MS-9. And after they get into orbit, they release their seat belts, and eventually they're actually able to take off their flight suits. And this all happens in the orbital module. That's the one in front of them. That's also the same one that docks with the space station. So apparently they believe it was hit with a micrometeorite when it's attached to the space station. You know, they've been up there. I think these three people got up there in June. Alexander Gerst, it was a ham, KF-5ONO, and another American, Serena Anon. She's happens to be another ham as well, KG-5TMT. They were taken up there with a Russian who flew it up there in June, and they don't plan on coming back until December. So they examined this little hole, and the Russians wanted to fix it right away, and they put duct tape on it. The commander, Fusel, he's from the States. He's a NASA guy. He wanted to hold off on it, you know, really do it right. They didn't want to make a mess of this and have more of a problem later on. But the Russians went ahead with it. They talked to Moscow, and Moscow said, here's what you're doing. It's their piece of equipment. So they put some kind of epoxy on it, some other kind of gauze type of tape, and apparently it slowed or stopped it. They won't need this module when they leave in December, when these three people, two of our Americans, and actually, you know, one American, one European Space Agency guy, that's Alexander Gerst. When they get into Soyuz and leave, they'll be in the descent module, the middle one. And so what happens right before they re-enter, the descent module separates at exactly the same time with the propulsion module and with the orbital module, the one that's leaking. And that's how they come back. They come back to the descent module. And that's the one that has the parachutes. And eventually, they land in the steps of Kazakhstan, hopefully safely in December. So that's the story on that thing. You know, if there was an emergency, worse than that, you know, they do have contingency plans. Russia would actually launch unmanned Soyuz spacecraft. They actually have them ready all the time. They put it out on the air. Out at Baikonur in Kazakhstan, and they would blast an unmanned spacecraft up, bring people back. And it's not that unusual. They've actually done that many, many years ago. Russians got into a jam and did exactly that to save the crew. They launched another spacecraft up. So that was interesting. Before I go on to another topic, does anybody have any comments or questions on this one? This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report.
Paul, I think I read that was a 2-millimeter hole. I guess it was a very small micrometeorite that penetrated the Soviet spacecraft. I wonder if they found any pieces of it. You know, it came through from the outside. Did they find any pieces? It didn't go all the way across the spacecraft and out the other side, so to speak. 2-millimeter diameter is a fairly small hole. Is that the biggest hole that has ever appeared on the International Space Station that you know of, Paul? Over to you, K2RIW.
That's the biggest hole that's ever come into the space station. Well, nothing's ever actually come into the space station. And I haven't heard a report of actually finding something in the space station itself, but I'd be looking for that. This came out by their, you know, they have a bathroom type of setup in the orbital module, and it's right behind that they found it. And actually, Gerst found it first, the European Space Agency guy put his thumb over it. They knew what it was right away. But I did see a picture of it, yeah, and it's 2 millimeters. It looks like a very, very small hole. It's round. It's not elongated. You think if it hit on the outside, you might have, like, you know, a blast on the inside, like it was hit with a bullet or something. It's round. 2 millimeters is small. But still has to be repaired. And they apparently have repaired that thing. So, yeah, you're right. That's what it was. I would like to, you know, do an EVA and look at the outside of the spacecraft before I went home. I would definitely want to see that. Back to
you. C2IS, query.
Recognized. They said the rest of the International Space Station is shielded, and that kind of penetration wouldn't take place. This portion wasn't shielded. What does that shielding consist of? Back to you, Paul.
Well, I know you have roughly 4-inch thick walls all the way around the space station. And, you know, you have, there's everything from aluminum on the inside to Kevlar type of material in between, all kinds of different insulation, different mylar insulation. So, you know, I guess they consider that protected. But the Soyuz spacecraft is very heavy duty. I mean, you know, when they built things years ago in the 1950s, they were getting ready to, you know, launch Sputnik and eventually people. You know, they were really coming out of the nuclear days with the ICBM, and anything that they launched back then was very heavy. They had the capability of shrinking down their nuclear bombs like we did when we dropped it. Their technology was not that good, in that respect. So they had these very heavy atomic bombs that they needed to eventually put into these ICBMs. So everything was heavy duty. The rockets were extra heavy duty. The vehicles that they would send it up in was heavy duty. So when they were building the manned spacecraft, their orbital and descent modules, they are pretty staunchy. Probably more so than the space shuttle was. But, you know, I don't know. I'll have to compare. Back to you, Dick, and then there was somebody else.
Go right ahead, Bill.
Yeah, I've got two RF questions that I could pose. If you guys are done with the space talk, let me know. AC2IS.
That's up to Paul, if he wants to make an interruption. Over to you, Paul.
I have a few more topics, but, you know, this primarily is a technical. You know, anytime you have a real technical question, as long as Dick is still here, that takes priority as far as I'm concerned. And then SpaceNet and Science Talk, you know, we're secondary. I would go with that. Back to you, Dick.
Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, these are two... kind of hypotheticals. One was just I spoke to a vendor recently who was describing some RF problems. They had RF links carrying internet traffic, and these systems, when there is rain, or they said when there was sleet, their receivers were seeing received signal strength for some reason go much higher than normal, which confused me. I thought that if there was rain or sleet, that would serve to diffuse the signal coming at them. These would be with highly directional antennas pointing at each other. I forgot to ask the question of if there was a possibility of other transmissions being in the area on the same frequencies that maybe they were seeing energy from other people's transmissions, but I think they were describing relatively remote locations, so I'm thinking that would not be the case. So that was one question. Do we know anything that might explain that increase in received signal strength? They said to the extent where receivers were being burned out. AC2IS.
When it comes to free space loss, empty space has the minimum loss. Anything you put there is going to be an attenuator. Even a piece of waveguide would be an attenuator, would you believe? Transmission line and waveguide would be more of an attenuator than free space. So that certainly is confusing, Bill. Where did you read this, and is it a well-documented site? Over to you, Bill.
Sorry, maybe I think I came in a little bit too quickly. Let me let this drop for a moment. Let's see. This was Thursday night. I was stuck late at work, and there's a vendor that came in to do some fiber work. And this vendor came in with a contractor that was actually doing the work, and the vendor was just there and started talking about other problems that he had run into at his company. And I asked if he had ham radio operators within the company, and he said no. So I was hoping to get one of these guys onto the TechNet and to directly ask the question without a go-between like myself trying to relay the information. The second query was related to a video I saw on YouTube where it seems maybe tangentially related. There was a guy with a key fob for his car. He pressed the button that would normally unlock the doors and flash the lights on the car, and he was standing sufficiently far away from the car where that did not work. So, you know, he's on camera, he's there, he's pushing the button, and you see off in the distance the car does not react. Then he takes a jug of water and he holds it up in between the car and the key fob, fairly close to the key fob. He presses the button on the key fob again, and this time the lights on the car do flash. It does unlock. And so the guy is saying, you know, therefore, this cylinder of water, cylindrical container of water, plastic container, I believe, I believe it's just the water that's interacting with the RF. He says, this cylinder of water, therefore, is acting as a lens and is focusing the RF towards the vehicle. I'm wondering if in either rain or sleet conditions, could this possibly be happening? In Vendor, again, it seems extremely unlikely that it could increase the received signal strength to the point where they would be burning out receivers, but this is what the vendor is describing. AC2IS.
That sure sounds crazy, Bill. I don't accept it. Yeah, the jug of water acting like a magnifying glass, I sort of accept that. And on top of that, you always have multipath. Was it really the focusing action of the jug of water, or was it the bounce on the jug and the bounce on the ground where previously the line of sight and the bounce on the ground were canceling each other? I mean, I've had the situation where, for instance, you hold a RFID reader at waist height, and you stand 16 feet away from a tag. The ground reflection and the direct path through air end up 180 degrees out of phase. If you move further than 16 feet away, the signal gets stronger. If you raise or lower your hand, the signal gets stronger. So the jug of water could be a multipath situation as opposed to focusing, but it would look like the focusing was doing it. But to make a free space signal across multiple miles get strong enough to burn out a receiver, that sounds impossible. Typical free space loss, quite often you get 85 or 90 dB of loss in the first mile. When you make something 90 dB weaker, that's a billion times weaker, is that going to burn out the front end of a receiver? I sort of doubt it. Over to you, Bill.
Okay, so then the question that I did not think to ask the vendor, the next question that I guess I thought of finally is, hey, is there a possibility that there's some other transmission on the same frequency, you know, some other competitor of theirs in the same area, and that maybe they're seeing RF come at them because it's being diffused away from some other transmitter? And actually, now that I'm thinking about it again, what are the odds that the rain or the sleet are reflecting signal back towards the transmitter from a very near distance? Because each transmitter is also going to have a receiver. I would think they would have each transmitter on the opposite side operating at a slightly different frequency, but I don't actually know the details. If there's some reflection from water or sleet in the air, could that possibly bounce back enough energy to burn out the local receiver, AC2IS?
Very unlikely. You think a great big object like a water tower is going to give you a huge echo. Calculate what's called radar cross-section. How big an echo is it? it's extremely small. Bigger than free space, but still very small. If the reflecting device was 100 feet in diameter and an exact parabolic or an elliptical shape, so it's a huge reflector and all of it is focusing, yeah, maybe you can get enough energy. Even then, enough to burn out the front end, something is wrong. They had a receiver failure. They thought it was a front end burnout because of strong signal, is a guess on my part. All of these...